Okay, your assignment was to recreate John 16 and send it in by November 15th. Now, John 16, let me ask you, was it easier to recreate that than it was the previous assignment? Do you feel like you're starting to get a little feel for it? Yeah, and that's part of the process. Hopefully, each time you'll get better. It won't be that there aren't challenges along the way. I'm going to go over some of it, but because of time, I'm not going to go over all of John 16. But let's just begin by looking at some of the first verses, okay? John 16. Notice, I have spoken these things. Now, I rearranged the words a little. It's okay to do that. If you didn't, that's okay as well, as long as you have the main subject, verb, and object or object complement on the top line, okay? Or at least left justified, even if it's not the first thing. I have spoken these things to you. This, you should be able to read this when you're done in a way that makes sense. I've spoken these things to you. I've spoken these things that you should not be made to stumble. Okay? Number two, they will put you out of the synagogues. Yes, the time is coming that whoever kills you will think that he offers God's service. Now, keep in mind, this is discourse. And what is the thing you must remember again about discourse? Even though something may not be the main subject and verb, the content of the statement is the key point, though it may not be the main subject and verb. Okay? So you want to remember that about discourse. Or, I spoke these things to you that, and everything after that's going to be the key that is being highlighted, but grammatically that isn't the main subject and verb. Okay? And that's the exception of discourse. Now, when you're doing narrative or you're doing something that's just explanatory, you will see that normally the main subject and verb are the main point. But when it comes to discourse, that isn't the way it is. And John 14, 15, 16, 17 is all discourse. 13 has some discourse in it, and it's all called the upper room discourse. Chapter 16, verse 3, and they will do these things to who? To you. Why? Because they have not known the Father, nor because they have known me. And again, remember, things are subsumed. It's very normal in language to subsume things. Okay? Number, verse 4, but, contrast, I have told you what? These things I have told you. Why? That you may remember. When the time comes, that you may remember that I told you of them. Now, you could have put of them down further if you wanted to. Again, this is where this isn't such a precise science that there's no flexibility based on the observer. He can break it down, but it has to be broken down to some degree. Say, well, I kind of like full sentences, you know. Well, then you're not recreating at all. Okay? Yes, Philip? Yes, introduced by that. Okay? And I did not say these things to you. I did not say these things at the beginning. I did not say these things because I was with you. And you notice, those are all coordinate, and they all make sense when you read them that way, and that's how they should fit. If you've done it right, it should make sense like that. But now, you got a contrast. I go away to him. I go to him who sent me, who modifies away or him? Well, him, so that's why it's double indented. Okay? To him. And none of you ask me, where are you going? Okay? Verse 6, because I have said these things to you, sorrow has filled your heart. You see, if to you, if you put it just a single indent, but to you, sorrow has filled your heart, doesn't make sense. To you is going to, again, have to be subordinate to, because I've said these things to who? To you. See, to you clearly modifies, as it were, the phrase, because I've said these things to you. It does not modify but. Sure. So you just move this up here. Yeah, that's fine. Yeah, you can rearrange it as long as it comes all right. Okay? Sorrow has filled your heart. Nevertheless, I tell you the truth. Period. It is to your advantage, what? That I go away. For if is a conditional clause, so it has to be indented. I do not go, if I do not go away, the helper will not come to you, but if I depart, another conditional clause, I will send him to you. So it's to your advantage that I go away. Why? Because the helper won't come if I don't, but if I depart, I will send him. And again, you are seeing through this, though, some of the main thoughts the Lord is communicating. And when he has come, by the way, notice the Holy Spirit's referred to as a he, personal pronoun, has come. He will convict the world. Key thought of the verse. Of sin and of righteousness and of judgment tells us something of the content that he will convict the world of, or reason why he'll convict the world of. That's going to be a little bit of an interpretative judgment. And then verse 6 basically, again, subsumes. He will convict the world of sin, because notice here how you had it. So you're going to follow this through? See it? Okay. Of sin, double indent, because they do not believe in me. He will convict the world of righteousness. Why? Because I go to my Father and because you see me no more. Okay. Verse 11, he will convict the world of judgment because the ruler of this world is judged. See, of this world is actually, you could, you know, put it here, of this world is judged, or just leave it in there. I still have many things to say. I still have many things to say to you, but you cannot bear them now. However, when he has come, the Spirit of truth, okay, when the Spirit of truth has come, but notice, and then who is the Spirit of truth? And keep in mind, there are times, multiple times, when you're recreating where you're going to want to bracket who is. Because that is the idea of it. Who is the Spirit of truth? He will guide you, where? Into all truth. Why? For he will not speak on his own authority, but he will speak whatever he hears, and he will tell you things to come. By the way, this is the promise of the Spirit of God's descent, specifically on these apostles, for the objective of divine revelation, which the New Testament consisted of. And he will glorify me. Why? For he will take of what is mine, and he will declare it to you, is the idea. Okay? And so hopefully, at least, you know, I just glanced at your papers yesterday because I didn't have time to look at them closely. And I, at least it seemed to me that you were getting it for the most part. Again, there are some judgment calls along the way, but you want to pick up the main things for sure. How far you want to break it down is a judgment call. But rule of thumb is break it down as far as you can and still feel comfortable. Sometimes it can be broken down so far that you kind of lose the forest from the trees. Okay? But you're going to see in observations, you're going to want to look at the trees, but not lose sight of the forest. The forest is the context. The trees are the content. But you don't want to break it down so far that you lose sight of the whole thing. So I'm just going to jump ahead here to our next, because of time, move into this whole area of observation. And you should have a handout that was sent to you regarding this. I sent it late. I hope Jim sent it to the outlying areas. He gets it on his iPhone. He should have done it. Okay, number 5. Observe the content grammatically and syntactically. Grammatically and syntactically. Question, what's the difference between grammatical and syntactical? Okay? This is just step number 5 on your exegetical process, okay? And then I will move on to how to observe, okay? But let's look at grammatical and syntactical. What's the difference? What's a grammatical observation and a syntactical observation? Robert?
I would take what Tom taught us in Greek, grammatical
Yes, okay. And so what Robert said was, again, the grammatical involves looking at the words, their tense, their moods, or so forth, their case. Syntactical is looking at their relationship to each other. And that's a really good way to remember it. Okay? So you're going to see when you do grammatical observations, you're going to look at every word, or at least the key terms. You're going to break them down. You're going to look at its meaning. If it's a verb, you're going to look at mood, tense, voice, so forth. Yeah, if it's a noun, you might look at case. You might look at person, so forth. You're looking at that. But when you're looking at syntactical observations, you're looking at the flow of thought. You're looking at, oh, notice that word is mentioned four times. Or look at that word, but. That's a contrast. There's a contrast between that statement and that. Those are syntactical observations. You follow so far? So you're looking at relationships. Now, how to observe a passage. The background. What is observation? Observation is the process of recognizing and recording the information of a passage. Recognizing and recording the information of a passage. When you're doing observation, you're recognizing what's there. Now remember my story, I'm driving in on Jean Duluth and I'm not noticing houses, right? I'm not recognizing what's there. It's there. And you know, there is a lot more in front of you in the text of Scripture than you begin to see. It's there. But the purpose of observation is to see what's there, to recognize it, and then to record it. Because if you don't record it, you won't remember it, right? Won't remember it. So what is its purpose? Observation answers the question, what do I see? And it's crucial to accurate interpretation. Remember, the better you are at observation, the less you will have to do of interpretation, and the better you will be at application. In fact, more and more, the better you are at observation, the less interpretation you're going to have to do. Now, this is what most people do. They read the passage and they immediately start to interpret it. They don't observe what's there. Now, being at DBC, even just the way we teach here, we're calling your attention to the text a lot. Okay? We're pointing out a word. We're pointing out what's there in front. We're trying to help you learn to see what's there. And we're not trying to pontificate some point without supporting it. We want you to see from the text, first of all, this is what's there. Now, to whatever degree you delve into the text, to whatever degree you unravel the text and how deep you go, will be a subjective call on the part of the teacher based upon his objective and his audience. And I say that because, you know, there are some doctrinal guys out there that were told at seminary, unless they parse every word in the Greek and the verse, that they're not doing their job. Well, usually people that do that lose the forest from the trees. You want the point, not all the details. You don't want to show off, as it were. You know, if you had a nice piece of furniture, do you put the furniture out there, or do you say, hey, look at the tools here, man, these are great tools. Didn't I do it? Don't you like my tools? Or would you say, no, look at the furniture. And the objective of the teacher is, look at the furniture. Now, you might have to explain, look at the furniture. Did you notice the legs? And by the way, did you notice the cushion? How thick? And you're calling your attention to the furniture, not to your tools. Okay? So that the people walk away getting the point. So when it comes again, observation, what does the text say? Or what do I see? Interpretation, what does the text mean? Application, what am I to do? And again, you will be tempted to jump in your observations to your interpretations. Instead of saying, no, I'm just observing it here. This is what I see. Now, sometimes there's a fine line between what do you see and what does it mean. And you will cross over at times, and it's kind of like, you know, North and South Korea. You want to be careful when you're crossing over, you know. Okay? Basic procedure, what do you look for? Now, I had to add things. In the past, it was utilizing your eyes, mind, and a pencil. But who uses a pencil anymore, right? When you have a word processor, you don't need one. Keyboard or whatever. And your study helps, Logos, whatever you use. You need to know, number one, the main subjects and verbs. The main subjects and verbs. Now, if you're doing your process right, would you have already done that? Yeah, in your recreation, right? So you've already observed them, at least what they are. You may not know exactly what the words mean, or what tense, mood, and voice, and so forth, the verb is, or what case the noun is. Well, you should know that. But what does it mean? So you've got a lot more to go, but at least you've identified it. You've identified it. Number two, you want to look at the definitions of key terms. Now, depending on how much time you have, you may want to look at every word. You know, in the past, when I've studied quote problem passages on eternal security and other things, I have looked at every word in those verses. What they mean, what's being said there, how they are used in that book, how are they used in the New Testament, so forth, so forth. Now, a lot of times, due to time constraints, you can't look up every word and do every word the same justice you would to key terms. So somewhat you're looking at key terms. If you have time to do every word, that's really good. If you don't, you want to look at key terms. You say, well, how do you know what's a key term? Right? Well, your main subject and verbs are key terms. Your object or object complement usually is a key term, obviously. And there are other terms that you say, wow, I wonder what that word means. What does that mean? Not by way of interpretation, but by way of definition. Definition. Number three, you want to note things that are emphasized, repeated, related, alike, contrasted. How will you do this? By using your eyes again. Or in some cases, you might click on, as I did, for example, the word please in 2 Timothy 2:4 today. I clicked on please, and I saw where that word was used in the New Testament, but I also would have noted from that if that word was used in my passage again. Now, in John 15, are there any words that are emphasized? What words are emphasized in John 15? Love, abide, in, him, fruit. Right? So as you're looking through the passage, you're saying, wow, look at that. The word fruit is found this many times. Wow, that's a key term, obviously. Look at abide, look at in him, look at love, and so forth. So you're looking at words that are emphasized. Now, how do we emphasize things in English? How do we emphasize things? No, I mean as far as in writing. Just in writing. Okay, now today we use fonts and all this, but apart from that stylistic, how do we do that? Main subject and verbs. Those are things that are emphasized, right? Your main subject and verb, unless it's discourse, is your thing that is being emphasized in the verse. Now, we also, by virtue of fonts and so forth, we bold or italics or we put it in a different font or, you know, we can do a lot of things today. No, I understand. Yeah. Yeah. Robert just said in real writing that's not done. In my writing it is done, Robert. So, okay, that's okay. Okay. But things that are emphasized, you look at things that are repeated. Where you're going to be looking, you're seeing that word's coming up a lot. Okay. Things that are related. Boy, look at these things are related. Now, for example, in Hebrew parallelism, I pointed out in our study of Esau last Wednesday night, that he said the same thing twice, just two different ways. Be strong and don't let your hands be weak. That's just Hebrew parallelism. That's saying the same thing twice from two different angles. Okay? Things that are alike. Things that are related. Things that are alike. Things that are alike. How do we show in language things that are alike? Is, or and, or as. What about things that are contrasted? What do we use? But, or nevertheless, or We use prepositions oftentimes to indicate those kind of things. That's what you want to be observing. So, let me give you an illustration of that. Go to 2 Timothy chapter 2, where you see what you're learning and pondering will be used in exegesis, and what you're doing in exegesis is stuff that I think is vital. See, this isn't, it's never just single tasking here. I want you to be able to walk out of Gibbs with John 15 whistling in your ears. Okay? Because it's that vital of a passage. Now, how many of you have some software available to you? Or the Greek text or whatever in front of you? Okay? If you have it, you can pull it up if you'd like. Oh, some tips to remember first. Number one, make sure to record your observation or observations. And this is what an old saying of the past, faded ink is better than a good memory. Number two, make sure to understand the significance of an observation and don't merely state it. You say, oh, this is a present active indicative second person plural verb of dunamis. Oh, that's really good. What does that mean? What is the significance? Now, that's not interpretative fully. That's largely observation, though there could be some interpretation. So what's the present tense mean? What does the active voice mean? What does this mean? And that's where your grammar and your Greek all dovetail when it comes to exegesis. So to tell me what it is but not tell me its significance isn't going to help me much or help you much either. To tell us what it means, all you need is a Bible Works or Logos, and it'll. But what does it mean? Tell me what it is. Okay. Number three, try not to jump to interpretation while making observation. Number four, pay careful attention to detail. You know, it's been said the devil's in the details, not in exegesis, okay? Detail, grammar, relationships, and word usage. And keep in mind, when it comes to the meaning of a word in a passage, what are the things you're going to do? And we will learn how to do word studies. But the bottom line meaning of a word in a passage is based on its etymology, and number two, on its usage. Etymology and usage. For example, trunk, again, context determines it, right? So it's usage in a context that ultimately determines the meaning. I think I might have shared this with you before. It's like the word nice. You know where we get the word nice from? From the French. It's the word for idiot. So if you come up and say, you're really nice, you better be careful. You're not sure what that means, right? So if we went by pure etymology, would we come up with the right meaning? No, because at times words change their meaning. Gay, you know, it's changed its meaning. Over time, Hallmark found that out here in the last 2 weeks, didn't they? Okay? Number five, and this I forgot to put on your handout, you want to add this. Do your own study before consulting commentaries. Now, commentaries are different than Bible software programs that deal with the text. Commentaries. Now, why do I say that? Because people are always prone to say, oh, this is a little hard. What does so-and-so say about this? And you jump to your commentary. You do not touch your commentaries for a while in this, you'll see. After you've done your own homework, then you look at your commentary. And then you may adjust some comments, or you may add some comments, or you might say, this commentator is out to lunch. Okay? But you won't know how to evaluate and utilize those things without it. Okay, now, and some of the text didn't come over the same I would like it to by virtue of fonts again. But here is 2 Timothy 2:1 in the Greek. Okay? I just took the text as it would go horizontal. I put it vertical. And I'm going to show you each word. You got su, u, te, mu, indanamu, and so forth and so forth. Okay, so here would be your Greek text. Here is, it tells you what each one. Now, What's really nice is your Bible software program does that for you. Okay? Now, there was a day when there was no programs like this. There was a day you had to learn Greek, and you had to learn every part of Greek. You didn't have the quick route like you're doing. You know, if you think Greek is hard here, Greek is nothing here compared to what you would in a class. You would memorize a ton of stuff and work things through. But this is what the Greek text would look like if you put it in a linear morphology. Now, I'm just going to break down each of the words here and just show you the significance of things. Okay, you've got your first word, Sue, translated you here. And it's in the singular. Nominative case, what is that going to tell you? It's the subject, right? And you in the context is referring to Timothy. You, therefore, my son. Who is he talking to? He's talking to Timothy. So if you're making observations and you're recording these, you want to state what the Greek word is, you want to state everything you can tell me about that word, and you say, well, that's interpretative, referring to Timothy. I mean, someone might say that, okay? Well, that's okay. That's a good observation, okay? Next one is, should be un here, un, okay? Therefore, that's how it's translated. It's a conjunction. It transitions from chapter 1 and 2. Now, keep in mind, in the original text, were there chapter divisions? No. But the word un is going to be act as a little signal to you that we have here a transition. That's calling you back in light of what you read in chapter 1. Therefore, now listen to what I have to say. Okay, so what are you doing? You're looking at the word. You're looking at what it means. You may look at how it was translated. You're telling me, what is the significance of a conjunction? And that's a subordinate conjunction. Okay? Subordinate conjunction. So what does a subordinate conjunction do? What does a conjunction do? It joins. It's a conjunction, right? Joins. And therefore, here, joins chapters 1 and 2, transitions from chapters 1 and 2. Okay? Here's our next word, technon. Singular, translated son. You therefore, my son. Used for a familiar or affectionate address due to their close relationship. So where do you find that out? By looking at how the word is etymology and usage. Etymology and usage. Okay? Now you've got the word mu here, translated my. That is a pronoun modifying son. Okay? So observations you're making what the word is, what does it mean, how is it used, what does it modify if it does. You're recording all of these things. Okay? Now here's a much longer one. Here's our word endunamu. Translated, be strong. In this case, it's referring to enablement, empowerment, strength, or ability, inwardly. In dunamu, it is your main verb. It is in the present tense idea. Now, I'm just going to tell you something about present tense. There's different kinds of presence, obviously. But they all basically boil down to current or continual. Current or continual. Okay? It could be historical present. But normally it's current or continual. Okay? In other words, it's habitual or it's going on right now. And that's the way we use present tense verbs too, usually. It's going on right now or it's something that's a habitual kind of thing. Okay? It's in the passive voice. Passive voice, significance of that is it receives, again, the action. Could be translated, be strengthened. Now, one of the things I will let you do in your observations is you may say, In the English Standard Version, it's translated this. If you think you find another translation that really nails it, you can refer to that. Put that in your notes. That's okay. Okay, here's another one. It's in the imperative mood. That means it's a what? It's a command or it's a necessity. It's necessary in order for other things to occur. And by the way, imperative moods are also the will of God. How does God communicate his will? By imperative moods. Okay? It's a necessity. It's indicating the will of God. Literally, keep on being strengthened. And this is a command of necessity. Now, what I did was I did another thing here beyond the passage. I'm just going to show you another thing you can do. Let's say you click on your word search, your word lemma, or whatever, and it starts to show you where this word is found in other passages. Now, you can click it on in a way in which it will actually show you how that same form where that's found. Or maybe the same word, but not in the same form where it's found. And that may be of value, things that you want to note those things. Again, you're observing, you're recording, you're recognizing, you're trying to put this together. Now, as you work your way through and you start to get to interpretation, at times you may adjust some things, as you'll see. The more you work through, you might change some things. But you're, again, recording, recognize. Because frankly, students, it's all there. And it's even in your software program, it's made it even easier. But the thing that you don't know what to do yet is, so what? Okay, it's this, so what does that mean? And that's why you're learning grammar and Greek to go along with this, so that you're walking away with meanings. Now, English grammar and Greek, there's a lot of overlap. A lot of overlap. Now, there's differences too, but there's a lot of overlap because they're part of the same family of languages. And so what you're learning in English and learning will help you in Greek, and Greek will help you in English, and both will help you in exegesis. And observation is probably perhaps the most critical aspect of exegesis. If you do it well, you will have less interpretation to do. So, by the way, this should be 1:12 there. So forth. Those are just four places that word is found. Okay? Now you have the word in, or en in the Greek. Could be in the locative, in the sphere of, or could be a dative of means, by means of. Now I'm going to do a little interpretation here, a little interpretative thing. I prefer the latter because it is a passive verb followed by a preposition. So in a passive verb, you're immediately asking what? So who is doing the action? Where is the action coming from? So here, right on the tail of that, you see this preposition found. Keep on being strengthened by means of the grace that is in Christ Jesus. Then you have your definite article connected to the word charis, and you've got charis there. Grace, referring to God's undeserved blessings and resources. Where do you find that? Again, you have a definite article connected with Christ here. Hodges, in his interlinear, that's Zane Hodges, by the way, in the interlinear, says this should be translated, which is in, locative, modifying Christ, emphasizing positional truth, Christ Jesus. Now, I went quickly, just trying to give you a little sense to this. How many observations did I make in verse 1? Probably, I would guess, anywhere from 25 to 50. One verse. It's all there. And I'm sure there's a lot more that could be made. It's all there. So what are the things you're going to be looking for? The meaning of the word. You're going to be looking at its case, or if it's a verb, its mood and voice and tense and so forth. You're going to look at what does it modify. Now, I'm not going to ask you in your assignment to do any syntactical observations, only grammatical observations. fact, I want you to make 75 observations on John 15, 1 through 5. Okay, 75 observations on John 15, 1 through 5. Now, the first time you go through this, you might only come up with 20. You're thinking, man, I'm going to really have to BS a lot on this one. You know, no, Bible study a lot on this one, right? But no, you just go back and keep looking. They're there. Okay? So what you're going to do is you're going to not only tell me basically what you see, but its significance. Make sure to note the significance of each observation. You might say, well, this introduces this. This concludes this. This contrasts this. Now, those are some relational things, but they are just part of normal observation. They're part of grammatical observation as well. Okay, and then syntactical, and you say, well, what if I get some syntacticals in there? If you do, you do. That's okay. I'm not trying to draw, again, such a definite line. I just want you to see as much as you can. I want you to take that orange and squeeze and squeeze and squeeze some more. And then next time when you have to give me 50 more observations on the same passage, you'll squeeze some more. Okay? Yeah. Man, I'm down to the rind, and hey, it doesn't taste real good. Yeah. No, you saw my significance, just a statement. It's a statement. This is the main verb, and therefore this is... So what's the significance of a main verb? What's the significance of a main subject? What's the significance of a direct object? See, so partly what you're doing is you're drawing on your understanding of the parts of speech to determine what the significance is, because isn't that what the part of speech does? Isn't a direct object for a reason? So what's the significance of a direct object? That's basically what you're going to tell me in the context. What's the significance of the main subject? What's the significance of the main verb? This is a conditional clause which states a condition that needs to be fulfilled in order to, and you haven't been taught yet first, second, third, or fourth class conditional clauses. I don't expect you to know that. Just do what you do heartily is unto the Lord. And just do your best for Jesus. No. Or Gibbs purgatory. Someone was telling me last night, they had a little saying, they had a little saying around their house. It sounded like malaria. You want to go do this tonight? Well, I got Gibbs. It's kind of like, what, you got some disease? Oh, I got Gibbs. I got Gibbs. Yeah, so. Okay. Questions? Due date, December 7th. Isn't that the next time you meet? December 7th, next time you meet. Now, let me qualify a couple things about December 7th. First of all, that's Pearl Harbor. I'm just joking. It is Pearl Harbor, but that's not the significance. I will not be here. Kurt will not be here. And so the morning will be devoted to pondering Greek and English only, but it will be the normal time from 8 to noon on December 7th. I will give you an assignment to be fulfilled for the 21st, though. And on the 21st, Carol will not be here. But I do assure you there will be no required assignments over your Christmas break. Okay? It'll be a true break for you and us. Or a chance to catch up on some things. Yeah, that could be. At least it's not required catch-up on our part. A second thing I want to mention is this. In the Logos presentation that Kurt will make today, in light of our previous conversation between the two of us, he is going to walk through with you, again, how to make these observations on Logos. How to go to Logos and use that as a tool to make observations. So that'll tie in. Now, that's already been covered somewhat, but you can go back and he's going to show you. Okay, if you're going to do this passage, here's what you're going to do. And here's how you can use Logos to accomplish that objective. So, again, it's a coordinated effort that should help you in this. And I will tell you this. you know, English grammar is really helpful, Greek is really helpful, but in exegesis, it all vortex. And you will find great joy in looking in the passage and say, well, I never saw that before. Look, it's right there. It's right there. And by the grace of God and through the Spirit of God, you're going to see things right there in the text that are have an impact on you. And there is a certain joy of discovery on a personal level when you're studying the Bible that way. It's like, wow. And you're going to have some wow moments. You're also going to have some ugh moments. Ugh, I can't seem to see you here. How am I going to come up with 75? You know, 75, you'll see, isn't all that difficult. Okay, questions before we break? Go ahead. Yes, I want you to make... Grammatical observations. Okay? Hold off on the syntactical as much as you can. Because we will go back and do, I want you to make 20 syntactical observations on this passage. Okay?
When you're making observations, for me it would make, I would be inclined to just read it and make observations on what first the ones that
Okay, question is, Philip said he'd be prone to just look at it and start making some observations before he goes too much farther. You know, just things that are there. Great idea. That's what I would do first. The only thing is, remember, you're looking at the English, usually. And so you want to always check out your English observation with the Greek, make sure you got it right. And I say that because immediately, if you were doing 2 Timothy 2:1, be strong looks like what in the English? Active until you look in the Greek and it's passive. Okay? So you can look in the English and say, well, here's the main subject, here's the main verb, here's the object or object complement. You can do those kind of things. But when you're looking at the Greek, then you just make sure you double check your work. Okay? But I would do, that's what I would do. Just go and start making the main observations you can see right off the bat. Because you probably won't have your Greek text or your logos with you all the time, right? Or what about people in other countries that don't have access to software? We're teaching them exegesis in Zambia based on the English text. Can they do exegesis based on the English text? Yes. Can they do it as well as if they had a Greek help of some kind? No. We take them a whole layer further. But hey, the English text has a lot to tell you.